Okay, let me read a little bit from this book that is now in progress. I'll read from the very first of it, and then a couple of pages from the middle, and then two or three pages from the end of it, which means that we will ignore a few hundred pages that may not matter. Well, I think it will be clear. The day didn't begin that day. It started a very long time ago, in fact, over half a hundred years ago, before Luther Calvin Knox got off the boat and came inland to settle, only to have to go and live with the niggers when the war came. Before Wesley Knox took the ghost with him from the nigger camp and went to preaching and founded the college. Before Francis Priapus Knox got chased by the thing in the woods and went soft. Before Lottie Thelma Knox got in bed and stayed there for 30 years writing letters to congressmen. Before Socrates Knox went to work in the steel mill and discovered John C. Calhoun in the family tree. Before Adolph Knox Moore killed Wick the Frog, Victoria's new husband who sold Bibles with a broomstick on his grandmother's back porch. And before Isaiah Luther Knox rediscovered the ghost from the nigger camp and wrote this book. I might say that this is the first part of a trilogy, by the way, and all of these things don't happen in the first book. Some of them will happen in the second and third. It wasn't Luther Calvin Knox's fault, though, that he had to come over right before the Civil War. It wasn't his fault that the Knoxes had gotten run out of Scotland by Bloody Mary and had gotten run out of Ireland by the potato blight and had gotten at last run out of South Carolina by black labor competition, high prices, and Luther Calvin's father's ghost. And it wasn't his fault that during the war he had to be run off his land by Yankees when he didn't even know what a Yankee was. But it was his fault, his wife told him later on, that he hadn't had enough sense not to take his wife and innocent child off into the woods to live with a tribe of haunted niggers, a thing that could, she averred, mark a family for generations. Luther Calvin would answer her, distant as ever, that when he was herded off the ship at Charleston in the November evening rain, after a voyage on which his father had died and been buried at sea, he knew that things weren't going to go well. The rain was cold, the docks were gray and ugly and not at all new-looking as they should have been in the New World, and he could see no work. There were black men everywhere doing all the work, lifting things, pushing things, leading things, unloading and loading things. He had never seen a black man before except in a circus that had played Belfast, but they looked as if they by no means needed help in whatever it was they were doing. Right away he got separated from his wife, Chastity, and his recently widowed mother, and his five-year-old son, Wesley, because they were all pushed in a great mob up from the hold and down the gangplank and went spilling out into an even greater mob who were waiting and milling about on the dock where they all ran aslant into a great herd of French Jurog pigs who were also being unloaded. Luther Calvin's family, he would recall with mixed emotions, along with a number of other people, were thrust by the mob into the pigs and amidst great squealing and confusion swept away, not to be found till nearly Christmas. Luther Calvin wandered all the night, that first night, among the other emigrants, who were many, searching for Chastity, Wesley, and his mother. Lamps lit grayly the dun wooden buildings and the faces of the black stevedores glistening with rain, but nowhere did they light his family. Others, too, had lost parts of their families in the hog stampede, though only Luther Calvin lost all his, and there was much weeping and wandering about. All that remained to Luther Calvin was the family King James Bible and a book of Celtic fairy tales, both of which he always carried by hand, and a bundle of Wesley's clothes. Worst, he found out next morning, he had no job. A message arrived at the customs house addressed to the shipper's representative that the gentleman in New York upon whose newspaper solicitation Luther Calvin and the others had come to the New World to assist and manifest destiny by stretching the railway lines to the frontiers of civilization had died. The shipper's representative made this announcement to the Irish in assembly on the docks after they had waited all night to pass customs and had had no tea. He was a perfunctory, lisping man who, flanked by soldiers, immediately went on to regret that their baggage had been confused with a load of English woolens by the illiterate stevedores and had left at dawn for Kansas. In the riot that followed, amid the stir of rifle smoke, the cries of the black stevedores who had been dumped in the sea, the wails of wounded men, and the last screams of the shipper's representative, Luther Calvin, who was inclined to quieter riots, stepped across a white picket fence and entered the promised land. "Aye," he said to himself as he crept among the warehouses, "'tis sure. The fiend were in the garden before Mr. Adam were, and he don't like neighbors." The Charleston morning was brilliant. On all sides were green things, even flowers, although it was November. Whoops. The rain had vanished, leaving a fresh washed smell that seemed to come from the air itself once he had left the brimstone smell of the gunpowder and the docks behind. The sky was a blue that made everything whiter, and the day was neither too hot nor too cold. On both sides of the street were grand wooden houses, fresh and white, in which no one appeared to work at all, except the black people. That fact impressed Luther Calvin most of all. No one seemed to be working anywhere. There was much busyness everywhere, but no one except the blacks seemed to be working hard at being busy, and they were more busy than working. Merchant-looking men smiled, preachers smiled, women smiled, blacks smiled, even the horses seemed to Luther Calvin to be smiling. Compared with the scene at the docks in the long, cold night before, it was truly the Garden of Eden. His family and his dead father slipped in and out of his thoughts, and at last threatened to slip out altogether. By the way, I know sometimes that it gets awfully hard sitting and listening to someone read you a story, you know, unless you grew up in radio days and listened to Let's Pretend on Saturday mornings. So if it does and you want to stand up and say Simon Says or, you know, Stretch or something like that, please feel free. But as Luther Calvin walked, the neighborhood began to change and Luther Calvin's mood with it. Brick stores and stables and blacksmith shops began to crowd the street, and the houses became smaller and built in connected rows. There were fewer green things, and the cobbles of the street became rougher. The blacks were working in much heavier kinds of labor, and the whites that oversaw them were shouting and working too. Uneasily, Luther Calvin thought of his family wandering lost among the same streets all night, or worse still, lying hurt and unattended in one of the dim side streets, victims of the pig stampede in the night. The row houses gave way to shacks, where first lived lean white men like himself, and then more blacks with strange headdresses and no shoes. The blacks looked menacing to him, and their strange, unintelligible speech threatened him. Wild, wailing music and smells of unnameable things cooking swam in the air around him, and images of his family being taken away by these alien creatures, whom Luther Calvin was convinced could be cannibals, sent him into a true panic. His pace quickened. His family had all his mind again. He thought of the stockyards. Of course, the stockyards. The pigs would have gone to the stockyards. He stopped the first black man he found, his eyes lit with determination. "The pigs, lad, where are the pigs?" he shouted. "No, sir, no, sir, I ain't got 'em," the black man said, backing up. "Of course you ain't. The stockyards, man, the stockyards." "Ah, yes, sir. They be in the stockyards. That's right," the black man said propitiatingly, taking another step back from Luther Calvin and his demonic eyes. "Where are the stockyards? Quick!" "Yonder, sir," the black man said, pointing toward the sea, and broke into a run. Luther Calvin was more lost than ever. Yonder, he saw from the crest of a small hillock he climbed, lay in a direction through shacks and savannas as desolate as the very wastes of Egypt. It took Luther Calvin an hour to find the stockyards, and he ran the last of the way, chased by bony dogs. Nay, he thought to himself as he caught the scent of blood and dung, this was not your ordinary paradise. At the stockyards, he found a fellow Irishman at work who remembered that a herd of pigs had indeed come in the night before, accompanied by a number of Irish ladies and gentlemen and a few children. They had left messages, all of which the Irishman began to chant to Luther Calvin in a litany. He had barely begun when the soldiers came. Luther Calvin was asked if he had identification, money, and if he were Irish. Since the soldiers had blue coats, not red, Luther Calvin's fear was not great. He was going to report his lost family to them, in fact, when one of them hit him in the stomach with a rifle butt and told him to move. Within minutes, he found himself with another group of Irishmen being marched again through the aimless shacks of the blacks toward the edge of town, while one of the soldiers read a proclamation to them that all unattached Irish were being escorted from the city as a public safety measure as a result of the morning's disturbances on the docks. Some miles outside of town, on a desolate trail through scrubby pine thickets, under a sky that had again turned slate, they were abandoned by the soldiers, who left them with the advice to go north or west, and told them that they now had their names, and if they were caught again within or near the city limits of Charleston, sterner measures would be adopted. Luther Calvin wondered what those sterner measures might be as he looked around him at the desolation and the twilight. He had eaten nothing since he left the ship. It was turning cold again. There was no shelter in sight. His wife and family were no doubt also in another small group of Irishmen on a trail or highway out of Charleston, just as desolate as he, and what's more, with even less money than the few pounds he had. That night, he and his compatriots slept in a fireless pine lean-to in the forest, ate raw potatoes grubbed from a nearby field, and talked themselves to sleep with tales of poets and singers and the little people of Ulster and Down. Thus began Luther Calvin's life in the New Eden, and thus began his 6 week search for his family. Luther Calvin had grown up a gentleman who bore no malice against anyone except the Pope and his hirelings. He was a farmer with deep, staring eyes and a habit of talking to himself in the fields. He knew, as a good Irish countryman, that the earth was shared by many other creatures than himself, and the most part unseen ones. The sounds that he heard in the unfamiliar woods and marshes as he wandered in a semicircle around Charleston those next weeks could have come from them all, or worse, and his nights were spent sleepless, cold, and in terror at the spirits of this new land. But he was also a resolute man, and as he searched for his family, learned to beg food in exchange for an odd job here and there, to steal the late turnips in the ground, and to bear the disappointment of not finding a single trace of his family. His pounds were useless to him. He was laughed at when he tried to spend them. He became even leaner than he had been before and grew a beard. At last, soon after the 1st of December, when he woke in the morning with frost in his beard and his shoes had lost their soles, when he had searched every village and farm around Charleston without success, when his nights had become living visions from Revelations, when he had read all the Bible through again and the book of fairy tales through twice, when he had sung to the pines all the long ballads he knew to keep the creatures away in the night, he felt he had begun to possess the new land and to be possessed by it. And he found work. He was given a shed to sleep in and straw for a mattress by a farmer too small to have slaves and went to work in the fields. He helped with the mules and the winter crops, with the 3 cows and the mending of the wagon and the house and small barn and the sheds. The walls of the shed and the smell of the cooking kept the creatures at bay in the evenings and night, and the loneliness of his wanderings in search of his family were softened somewhat by the sound of the farmer's wife singing hymns as she cooked breakfast at dawn. In only a short time, he came to feel comfortable with the smell of pine smoke in the pre-dawn, mixed with crisp odors of pork chops and salt pork and biscuits, to listen for the chants of the field blacks, whom he now called niggers out of respect for the farmer's feelings, as they worked in the adjoining fields. And there was always enough to eat in the warmth in the evenings without the heavy smell of peat and the warm roughness of walls of wood around him instead of the cold dampness of Irish stone cottages where the wind whistled at night and the pantry was always empty. With the same resoluteness that he had searched for his family, he decided to settle and to wait. Then, one night he returned weary and damp from the fields and found his father waiting for him in the dimness of the shed. The old man was sitting cross-legged on the straw, smelling of the sea and looking gravely in front of him. He was covered with a grayish patina, and his hair was matted to his head longer than Luther Calvin had remembered it. Luther Calvin was startled, but remembered himself and said respectfully, "Hello, father." "Where's your family, boy?" his father said sternly. I've lost them, Father, Luther Calvin said. It's nice to see you here, Father. Never mind, boy. That ain't what you come over here for, was it? Where's your family? I don't know, sir. Is this all your mother and I worked for? To see you live in a shed like these blacks the rest of your days? They're called niggers here, Father, Luther Calvin explained. You know why you ain't found them, boy, his father said, in a booming voice, pointing his finger through the gloom at Luther Calvin's heart. Luther Calvin was surprised at how long his father had let his fingernails get. You ain't found them because you don't know where they be, ain't it so? Yes, Father. I thought so. I taught you to read and to sing and to work in the fields. You ain't forgot that, have you? No, Father. I wish I had me pipe and some tobacco. I thought there would be all the tobacco I wanted when I got over here, his father said peevishly. Well, I know where they be, boy, and don't you forget that neither. Sit down. Luther Calvin sat on the straw beside his father, who gave off cold the way a hot stove gave off heat. His father described a street and house in Charleston and made him repeat the description until he was sure he had it and made Luther Calvin promise to leave with the dawn to find his family. Then the two of them sat the rest of the night side by side, and his father told him the wonders of the bottom of the sea and the creatures that lived there and the men he had met and the trouble he had had in finding him. Luther Calvin told his father of the nights in the woods and of his search, but his father seemed to know it all already, though he listened in the painfully patient way he had listened when Luther Calvin was a boy and would tell him a story he already knew. His father asked him to light a candle and read some from the book of fairy tales, and interrupted him several times to make comparison between the creatures in the story and those that lived on the bottom of the sea, and to assure Luther Calvin that there were little people in the forest of the sea, too. Luther Calvin offered to read from the Bible, but his father refused and seemed about to get angry and told Luther Calvin never to read his children from the Bible, but always from the book of fairy tales, and to sing them the songs of the old poets and tell them the stories of the little people, because children should be led into the ways of truth and not superstition. Then, as the cold light of the dawn began to seep under the door, his father said to him, I'm the one who taught you to read and to sing and to work in the fields, and don't you forget that, son. It's time to go now, and don't you stop till you find what you come here for, what you promised me we'd find when you first started talking to me of coming here. Though I disremember all the things you said we'd find. There were so many of them. Now don't you stop and live like a heathen black man in a shed, and that's your father telling you now. Niggers, Luther Calvin reminded his father again gently, and they're not heathens, father. So much the worse for them, boy, his father said. Now go and do what I told you. Yes, sir, Luther Calvin said, and got up. He felt as if he had slept all the night, but was stiff. Are you coming with me, father? I can't, boy. I'm dead. Yes, sir. Take care of your mother, lad, his father said. His face was even more gray in the new light, and his eyes were deeper than Luther Calvin had remembered them. I wish I could cry, but I can't now, you know. I wish I had some tobacco, too. Goodbye, father. I'll say goodbye to mother for you. Goodbye, boy. Luther Calvin picked up the bundle of Wesley's clothes and the book of Celtic folk tales. He left the shed and closed the door. There was smoke coming from the chimney of the farmer's house, and he heard the hymn the farmer's wife was singing, and he smelled the salt pork she was cooking, mixed with the smell of the pine smoke and the damp pine woods nearby, smells he would live with the rest of his life. There was a thin fog all around him, so that the world looked to him as if it were hiding behind a veil. He glanced a last time at the shed and saw a small rivulet of water had followed him out the door and was slowly making its way toward Charleston and the sea. He turned in the same direction and set out briskly, thinking that the road to Charleston would be long, though he did not know until a sun-shadowed day in the woods years later, as he saw the flash and heard the trumpet of the shotgun, just how long the journey he was beginning that day would be, and how much wider the wildernesses and denser the forest would be than those on the road to Charleston. Well, I think I'll cut some of this since we're running a little short on time. dancing. No one stopped Luther Calvin to ask him for identification or if he were Irish when he got to Charleston. The dark riot seemed to have been forgotten in the continuing business of ships and slaves and commerce and the fraternal glow of Christmas that lit the city. As he entered the edge of town, the houses of the blacks and of the poor whites looked mostly the same as when he had left, only colder. But when he came to the row houses, he found that holly wreaths had sprouted from their doors and mistletoe from their stone arches, and that trees were growing inside the house before the windows. The white houses on the broader streets toward the docks were even more splendid, with wreaths in all the windows and trees inside as tall as two men. Tears came to Luther Calvin's eyes as he remembered Christmases in Belfast when his father was alive and when he was with his family. Strangers wished him a Merry Christmas, and some of the blacks tipped their hats to him as he passed. The street his father had described, he found at last in none of the sections he had seen before, but in an area of small squares and neat shops with ladies' and gentlemen's clothing displayed and their tastefully dressed windows. Tall beaver hats and frock coats and some, wide-brimmed hats and white suits and others, all sprinkled among other windows with long flowing gowns, knit shawls, gloves, lace, bags, and bolts of silk and crinoline. It was a busy time with ladies and gentlemen coming and going among the shops in the same clothing that was displayed in the shop windows, and carriages with black footmen in attendance waiting alongside the small squares, all as he remembered it from the English illustrated magazines. His problem was that the houses all looked like the one his father had described. Peering in at doors and windows, he wandered more and more downcast from shop to shop, house to house, jostled by the crowds, accosted by match girls, splashed by carriages. One thing that I'm doing, by the way, in here is playing with a number of various styles, a number of periods in literature, and it might be of some side interest to you to try to find some of those. At last, as he wandered spiritless near the end of the street, all in a jumble, a brougham and pair of grays thundered from one of the small squares and sent him leaping out of its way onto the curb. A beaver hat shouted with a laugh from the brougham, "Back to the woods, Father Christmas!" And Luther Calvin had lost the spirit even to throw a rock. He took shelter from the jostling by a small knit goods shop he had found himself in front of. One that displayed knit goods no different from others on the street. Dejected and muddy, he stared vacantly into the window, his mind lost on the peace of the farmer's shack and his eyes wandering among the fancy knitting. He had never felt sorry for himself before, not even when he was sleeping under the dripping trees. But he began to now. Father Christmas. And what would he do with his family if he found them? Buy them a carriage and a passel of blacks? He began to hum the last rose of summer under his breath. And then he saw it. The stitch. He recognized the stitch. There in the window in one white shawl was unmistakably the broad stitch he remembered from his childhood, his mother's. And in a pair of fine ladies' gloves trimmed with lace was the smaller, more crabbed stitch his wife used. Self-pity flew. He had found his family. He rushed into the shop. As he burst in, the tiny bell over the door tinkled resurrection. And the gray little proprietress threw her hands to her breast and flattened against the wall. Chastity, he demanded, and made for a door in the back of the shop, finding at a glance that the woman was the only person besides himself in the shop. Chastity! Oh, yes, please, the little woman squeaked. As he flung the door open and flung himself in with it into the room, the two women who had been knitting on wicker chairs in the room both leapt up and froze. Sweet Lord in heaven, his mother shrieked. Back! Chastity screamed almost simultaneously, "Back where you belong," and made a hex sign at him while her knitting fell in a heap at her feet, burying Wesley. "Chastity," he said again. "Back," Chastity demanded, "back among the demons you come from." She looked to the sky, still making hex signs. "Oh, sweet Christ, child in heaven, I call upon you in all your mercy to send this thing back among the shades it's come up from, and to protect two innocent women and an innocent child. Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name." Luther Calvin was stunned. "It's me, Chastity, your own husband." Aye, so you think you are, his mother said, snatching Wesley and the knitting from the floor and clutching them to her bosom, ready to flee into Egypt. If you were, you'd have pity on this child of your mortal self and go back to the shades. But I am immortal self, mother. Aye, so you think you are, you poor creature dead and dumped into the sea these 6 weeks, resting in the arms of your dear father. So you think you are, me poor dead boy. Mrs. Knox, what in the world's going on back there? Came the timid voice of the proprietress from the front room. Oh, Mrs. Carlyle, his mother answered. There's not a soul here but ourselves and a poor sad thing that thinks it's here among us, but it's not. So there's not a thing to concern ourselves about. Mrs. Carlyle stepped into the room behind Luther Calvin. Well, I should say there is something to concern ourselves about if you two ladies don't know this gentleman, she said sternly, though squeakily. Sir, she said to Luther Calvin, and put her hand on his arm to turn him around. Oh, Mrs. Carlyle, don't touch it, Chastity begged. Please, ma'am, your soul... It's solid, his mother said to Mrs. Carlyle touched Luther Calvin. Oh, me Jesus, it's solid. Me boy, me poor boy. Wesley had uttered not a sound, nor turned his eyes away from his father while he was battling to disengage himself from his net of knitting. In his grandmother's astonishment, she loosed her hold on him, and he and the knitting slithered down her into a heap on the floor. Once down, he wriggled from his net and stumbled to his father. Luther Calvin tried to take him, but Mrs. Carlyle held fast to his arm. Hands off me bloody ghostly arm, ma'am, he said, and pulled away from her. Wesley clutched his father's leg, the fire in Luther Calvin's eyes damped as he squatted and put his hands on Wesley's shoulders. Hello, lad, he said, not afeard. Wesley's eyes were serene, as they always were, until 60 years later, when he preached the sermon to the fiend. One of them was blue and the other brown, and they crossed when he was perplexed or meditative. They were crossed now. Hello, father, he said gravely. Grandfather found you. Ah, Luther Calvin said, and took Wesley up into his arms, then turned back to his mother in chastity. I'm neither shade nor demon, nor I've wished myself both in the past 6 weeks, and I've come for you at last. And I'll take a bit of decency and a greeting from all of you, and an apology to this poor lady who it seems has been kind enough to take you in and give you sustenance these last long weeks. And Lord knows what I would have wanted to come back to this for if I was a peaceful demon down amongst the shades. Seeing Wesley in his father's arms and no harm coming to him, Chastity took a tentative step toward Luther Calvin, as did his mother, and the next moment they were all clutching him and weeping except for Wesley, who never wept. Luther Calvin was placated. For years afterward, however, Chastity would awaken in the middle of the night and touch her husband to make certain he was himself, and for the rest of her life the impression would come to her at times that he was not solid. Okay, I think that time is running a little bit short. I'll read one more short section, and we'll let it go at that. You see, what happens is that they finally make their way inland through various tribulations, and Luther Calvin gets some land and so forth, and then the war comes, and Luther Calvin can't see fighting for either side, really, since he, you know, really has nothing to do with either side. And northern foragers come, and he winds up with a number of other men hanging a bunch of them. They have to go in the woods and live with some freed blacks who have been living on the land, who have gone back to earlier ways of life. They live in a kraal, in a kind of African compound. Have reverted somewhat to their religion and various other things. And eventually, the northerners come again. Luther Calvin escapes in a balloon. Because, you see, the blacks have... a balloon from a traveling road show has come down in the woods, and the blacks have gotten it, and they're dressed in the costumes they found in the balloon, which were Shakespearean costumes, since it was a Shakespearean troupe, with armor and breastplates and this sort of thing. The blacks are named Pocahontas and Uncas and Powhatan, and there's an Indian who lives with them named Washington. So that will explain part of it. Luther Calvin then walks back 150 miles after the balloon comes down in a pig pen near Chattanooga, and goes back to the woods and builds him a little lean-to there because his house has been burnt and so forth. And this is the first winter he was there. The only visitors he had the first winter were his father and mother. His mother, by the way, drowned shortly after that, too, in a stream and was swept. Oh, well, they have gone into a town nearby. You see, there's a gentleman named Mr. Mooney, Mr. Plutus Mooney, who is another Irishman who had met them in Charleston, and they ran into him because he was head of the Freedmen's Bureau, and he has been using the freed blacks in order to build him a nice little business thing, which he has gotten, and he's becoming a capitalist. You see, the book is really, in many ways, about the vanishing of the consciousness that dominated the world for all of history, up until the past, in England, I suppose, the past 200 years, and in the States, the past 100 years. It's about the triumph of the visible, in some ways, over the invisible, since we live in a very visible world nowadays. And so I chose this period because it's the very transition. I chose an Irishman because of his kinds of consciousness, and the black people with African backgrounds for their kinds of consciousness. And show what happened when these people get caught up in, after the Civil War in the New South, which is, for me, a metaphor for the new world, in many ways, that we live in. So, he's in a lean-to. The only visitors he had that first winter were his father and mother, who were waiting for him when he got up Christmas morning. His father's gray patina had settled in since Luther Calvin had seen him last, and his mother wore only the slip she had disappeared in. She had taken off her clothes to go bathing. Well, this caused Chastity great concern because she was certain that his mother had gone to judgment naked, which was an improper thing to do. Well, his father said, back where you started, eh, boy? Hey, you're looking well, said Luther Calvin. This is about 15 years later. Can't say the same for you, boy. Father, his mother said, it's Christmas. Wish Luther Calvin a Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas, boy. Don't expect a present. Are you not going to greet your mother? Hello, mother. Merry Christmas, mother. I've missed you. Oh, we've missed you too, son. It's not that I didn't want to see you, you know. It's that your father don't like blacks. Where's your family, boy? His father said. It seems I've lost them again, father. Damnedest man I've ever seen for not keeping up with his family. Still no tobacco around, I reckon. Eh, never mind. I couldn't smoke it if there was. Got to breathe to smoke. What do you plan on doing now, boy? I've not given much thought, father. You should love that woman you married, lad. On principle, you should. He paused to pick a barnacle from his beard. They'll be coming for you. You know that.
So I fear, father.
You wouldn't like that, would you? Well, you've naught to do with it. There's no getting away. Will you be staying a spell, father? I can't, boy. I told you once I'm dead. Got me own business to attend to now.
Aye?
Are you not going to say goodbye to your mother?
Aye, father. Goodbye, mother.
Oh, son, his mother said. And have you no more to say than that to your son before we go, his father said. And how should I, sitting here in me shift? Oh, Luther, don't go to judgment in your skivvies, whatever you do. They don't give you nothing else.
We're going, lad, his father said. You'll see us again.
I hope so, father.
Don't hope for it too soon, boy.
Now go get you some breakfast. And remember your father that's not had a bite of bacon for 12 years.
Or a bite of anything, for that matter.
And don't forget, a man's a man for all that, the poet says. Hear me?